last week. And so we're going to start there in chapter 19. I'm going to try to get through chapter 25. I don't know if I'll be able to do that or not. Seems like whenever I think I'm going to take a lot of time, I take very little time. And whenever I think it'll be quick, it takes me forever. So let's go ahead and start looking at chapter 19 of Deuteronomy. And this kind of begins this section that is going to be kind of headed by the idea of some of the things of the under the Ten Commandment that you shall not murder. And so that we're going to begin off, they're going to start out talking about the cities of refuge. And I don't really want to go into a lot of great detail about the cities of refuge. We know that, you know, a lot of us are very familiar with that. And it, obviously we don't have cities of refuge today where you could go if you had killed somebody and go there and wait for your trial. But this is the section where it talks about those cities. And so you can go there and you can wait and see until you can have, you can be tried, or you can't leave there for so many years. So I don't really want to spend a lot of time on that, but so I want to move on down to see how quick we're going to go tonight. We're just covered half the chapter. I want to go down and look at verse 14 of chapter 19. It says, "You shall not move your neighbor's boundary mark, which the ancestors have set in your inheritance, which you will inherit in the land that the Lord your God gives you to possess." So here we see that just like today, they had set out certain boundary markers that would mark the corners of their property. And they weren't to move those. And the idea, I think, that you know, obviously you would move those so that you could have more land. And a lot of times those would be moved around maybe some key areas where you could maybe get to some water or a creek or something. And also we need to remember that the boundary lines that were for the tribes was set by God. So they weren't to change those or to move those, because that would be taking away not something temporary, but somebody's family's, their permanent inheritance in the land. And so I think that was something that would have been very important to them, that those boundaries not be moved. And then I want to look at verses 15 through 21. It says, "A single witness shall not rise up against any man on account of any iniquity or any sin which he has committed. On the evidence of two or three witnesses, a matter shall be confirmed. If a malicious witness rises up against a man to accuse him of wrongdoing, then both the men who have the dispute shall stand before the Lord, before the priest and the judges who will be in office in those days. The judges shall investigate thoroughly, and if the witness is a false witness and he has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him just as he is intended to do to his brother. Thus you shall purge evil from among you. The rest will hear and be afraid and will never again do such an evil thing among you." So God takes the accusing of his people very seriously, accusing them of a sin that they would do. And he requires that you would have at least two witnesses, that you would have somebody come forth to bring this evidence. And we're going to see later on that there was also, there was some physical evidence in one particular case would be accepted. So I would see how physical evidence could also be brought in these matters as well. But I think we see that whenever God is looking at the witnesses, that he's expecting them to be honest and fair, because the rule for bringing a false charge against somebody, being a false witness, is you would suffer the same thing that they would have suffered that you would have charged them against. So if you were being a false witness of somebody that would be, you know, given the death penalty, then you as well, if you were found to be, you know, being a false witness in that matter, you would receive the death penalty. So we can see how that would discourage people a whole lot from you know, being that. And it even says that the rest will hear and be afraid and will never again do such an evil thing among you. So not only are these laws written by God to help stop this from happening, but it's kind of like a preventative type thing where it would cause people not to want to do it. And then he talks about here in verse 21, says, "You shall not show pity, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, and foot for foot." This is the idea that whenever you think about you know, showing pity or feeling sorry for somebody. Maybe he didn't know what he was getting him into. It says they're not to do that. It's to be, you know, life for eye and eye for eye. And we know that Jesus talked about this in Matthew, the fifth chapter. Beginning in verse 38, it says, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also." And so here we see that Jesus talks about this eye for eye. And he says, you know, he says, you heard it. You've heard that it was said. Whenever he says that, I think he's talking about when it was said in the law of Moses. And I don't think he is undoing necessarily the law of Moses, although we know that he comes to fulfill the law. But he is talking about how they would deal with somebody in their interpersonal relationships. So this old law is going to be passing away and changing. And I think this is the idea, one of these things that is going to be changing. So this has to do with how we as Christians today would deal with our interpersonal relationships. But there's another specific thing I want to mention. The law of Moses was written as a law in which they could, you know, praise and worship God and be obedient to him. But it was also a law that was written. It was a national law that was like their government type laws. So in the New Testament, under the New Covenant, God's law is not a governing law as the way that the Old Testament was. We have, you know, like in the United States, we have governing laws. We have laws that say that I'm not to, you know, to steal or rob people, even though it's against God's law. The earthly punishment for those laws is not carried out by the same way it would have been carried out in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, it would have been up to, you know, some of the families to take that forth, to carry out those punishments, to take that to the chief priests and the Levites. And so in that way, it's different than our law. Our laws today, we have a government that carries out those governing type laws. And then we have the spiritual laws through the New Testament. And so it's not that Christ is saying this was a bad law. It's just, I think he's saying this law is written for, you know, a governing type thing where they had to control, you know, the crime through their government. So that kind of ends my discussion on chapter 19. I guess I can open it up here and see if there's anybody has any thoughts or comments on that, or maybe correct me if I'm wrong. So if you want to open that up, we'll.
Yeah, Kevin.
Same thing every day.
Go ahead. I heard Eddie's voice. Go ahead, Eddie.
Okay. Kevin, I agree with you. I think there's a significant difference between the enforcement of wrongdoing by government and the enforcement of wrongdoing by individual. When Jesus talked there in Matthew chapter 5 about "you have heard it said," in every case, what he was doing was pointing out how that the first century Jews had essentially changed or perverted the law. In the book of Deuteronomy, the law was for the governing authorities, specifically for the priest who was investigating this matter. And then if the person was found guilty, as you pointed out, they would receive the punishment that the one they made the charges against would receive. But what happened in the first century was they were using this essentially as vigilantism. That if I think someone has done something to injure me, then I can use that as my authority to injure them back in the same way. And that's what Jesus was saying. This is what you've heard, but that's not what the law said. And what I'm telling you is, in fact, when you're dealing with your individual situation, you are essentially to forgive instead of trying to enact punishment or trying to enact justice. It doesn't mean government should not enact justice. Romans 13 makes that very clear. But we as individuals are not to be vigilantes.
All right. Yeah, very, very good. Thanks for helping us understand that better. Any other thoughts or comments? I thought I heard somebody else say something. All right. If not, we'll go ahead and look at chapter 20. And specifically, chapter 20 has to do with some laws about warfare. And in the very beginning part of chapter 20, it's going to talk about that when they approached a city to conquer it, as you can remember, the setting is where they are. They're about to go in and do a lot of this, conquering the land that God had given them there, is that they were not to be afraid or faint-hearted because God was going to be with them. And so if you think about this, I guess you could look at it two ways. One, it's a specific commandment by God, but also I think it's a type of commandment that is an encouragement to them. So it says, when you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God, who brought you from the land of Egypt, is with you. And so here he's, I think, giving them this commandment, and he's encouraging them all at the same time. And then I want to go down and look at verse 4 of chapter 20. It says, for the Lord your God is the one who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to save you. And I like that passage right there out of this little section the most, as it talks about God who goes with you to fight with you against your enemies. And the purpose that he says he does that is to save you. Now, I want to think about that as far as us today, because, you know, we're not commanded to go fight against any cities, physically conquer any lands. That is not what the new covenant, Christ's covenant, is about. That was the Old Testament. That was the Old Covenant. And so, but we are in a fight. It's different, though. And I want to look at Ephesians, the sixth chapter. Beginning, I want to read verses 10 and 12. It says, finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers and authorities, against the cosmic powers over the present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. So yes, we are in a fight, and we are to, it says, to be strong in the Lord and in his strength and in the strength of his might. I think oftentimes, I think when I get discouraged is when I'm depending on my own strength and my own might. And quite honestly, if I start depending upon myself, I fail. If we go on and read that, we're going to see he's talking about taking up this armor of God. You know, we go through and we'll look at, you know, there's the belt of truth, the breastplate of righteousness, shodding our feet with the gospel of peace, the shield of faith, and the helmet of salvation. How can I look at what God commanded the children of Israel? And basically, this is a very similar, the same commandment, except it's not a physical commandment, it's a spiritual commandment that he gave them. I can see how they, when they did what they were supposed to, the success that God gave them, and when they didn't, how God allowed them to, you know, to be destroyed. And so I think we need to look at that. We can apply this to our lives as well. Also, if you keep on reading in this passage, there's some people that are given some exceptions not to go fight in the war whenever there was a battle. And some of the there was three main exceptions that were given there. One is if somebody had built a new house and had not dedicated it yet. Or if somebody had planted a new vineyard and had not harvested it yet. And also if they had taken a new wife or a fiance. And so if you read some of the things, they were saying, well, you don't want, these are not the kind of people that you would want to take into battle because they might be distracted. I might be worrying about, you know, my new house. I might be worrying about, you know, my vineyard. You know, I need to get my grapes harvested so I can, you know, make my first payment so I can, you know, get the grape juice. Also, somebody, obviously, whenever somebody's first married, they're quite distracted. I personally don't think that that was why God gave this commandment, because I think that God is the one who was doing the fighting for the children of Israel. So it didn't matter their skill level, as long as they were obedient to God. But I think some of the other things that I read was this had more to do with receiving the initial blessing from God, and where if you were going to get a new house, that would be a blessing that was granted to you from God, a vineyard or a new wife or a fiance, those would be blessings that would be given to you by God, and the first fruits of those blessings. And so I want to look at a passage in Luke, the 14th chapter. Beginning in verse 16. This is the parable. It says, but he said to him, a man once gave a great banquet, invited many. And at the time for the banquet, he sent his servant to say to those who had been invited, come, for everything is now ready. But they alike began to make excuses. The first said to him, I have bought a field and I must go and see it. Please have me excused. And another said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen. I go to examine them. Please have me excused. Another said, I have married a wife and therefore cannot come. So the servant came and reported these things to his master. Then the master of the house became angry and said to his servants, go out quickly to the streets and lanes of the city and bring in the poor and crippled and blind and lame. There's 3 excuses that are given by these people not to come to the feast. We obviously know this is coming into the kingdom of God. And so there's 3 excuses that were given. I think in my mind, these 3 excuses line up almost, not word for word, but very close to these 3 exceptions that were given to the people in war. The first one was he had bought a field. I would think that if you had bought a new, I would call that a farm maybe. Now that would be very similar to buying a house, something that was new. You need to go and inspect it. Also, somebody that had just bought the oxen. That's something that you get to, that you buy to work with to prepare a field. I would maybe compare that to the vineyard. He was, he needed to go and check those things out to make sure that they were what they were, make sure they were taken care of, that they didn't have any problems that he needed to work on. And the last one here is word for word, where the person says he had just married a new wife. None of these people are given this exemption to go here in this parable, the kingdom of God. And I think just if I base that on the idea that these other people were given this exemption so they could experience one of these blessings given by God, I think the blessing that we receive of entering God's kingdom outweighs every physical blessing that God gives us in this life, and therefore takes priority over them. I hope, I kind of hope that makes sense. This is kind of the way I understood that. And I also want to look at Matthew, the 8th chapter, in verse 18. Now, when Jesus saw a crowd around him, he gave orders to go up to the other side. And a scribe came to him and said to him, teacher, I will follow you wherever you go. So here we have this scribe telling him he's going to follow Jesus wherever he goes. And Jesus replies to him, foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. So here we see that Jesus didn't really have very many of the physical blessings that God gives us. And then it says, another disciple said to him, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. And Jesus said to him, follow me and leave the dead to bury their own dead. That seems very harsh and cruel to think about that response. If you wanted to go and bury your father, some of the things said that maybe his father hadn't died yet. But it was the responsibility of the Jews to take care of their parents. That was their responsibility. The father may have already been dead and need to be buried. But I think this is the idea that following Jesus takes precedent over all of our responsibilities in this life, as well as takes precedence and priority over all of the physical blessings that we could receive from God. Also here in this chapter 20, whenever they were to approach a city, you were to offer it terms of peace. I want to make, you know, a little distinction here. The cities that were in the promised land, they were to go in and destroy those cities. No, they weren't to negotiate with them because of the wickedness of those people was full. They were to be completely annihilated, and everything was to be, you know, was to be destroyed, all the people, so that the people wouldn't influence the people. Now he's talking about cities that are afar off. So when they approached a city that was afar off, they could negotiate peace with them. And we see here in verse 11, it says, if it agrees to make peace with you and opens to you, then all the people who are found in it shall become your forced labor and serve you. However, if it does not make peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. So here we see that God sets forth the terms of the treaty. It's pretty strict here. You can either come and be our slaves or our servants, or we're going to besiege you. And these cities, they weren't to destroy all the people. They were only to destroy the men, or they were to keep only the women and the children and the animals and all that is in the city. All of it is spoil, and you shall take as booty for yourself, and you shall use the spoil of your enemies, which the Lord God has given to you. So here we see they were able to. They kept the children and the women and the animals of these cities here as well, and they kept it as spoils for themselves. And so the rest of this chapter kind of deals with how they, well, in verse 7, you know, talks about how they were to go in and destroy the cities and they were in the land, and talks about, you know, goes into some detail about the trees and cutting down of certain trees and constructing, things out of those trees to siege the city. So that kind of concludes my discussion on chapter 20. I'll open it back up. Anybody else has any thoughts or comments on chapter 20 as well?
We don't know who Jake's parents are. It never tells us.
All right. Does anybody have any thoughts or comments on that? I can hear everybody's opened up or unmuted. All right. If not, let's go ahead and move on to chapter 21. Chapter 21 kind of basically sets forth, there's five laws, I think, that are kind of given and expounded on here in chapter 21. And they all, some of the things I read, they had to do with the sanctity of life and some and personal responsibility. The first one seems like a very unusual law when you first start reading it. It talks about if a slain person is found in between two cities and nobody knew who killed them, that, what they were supposed to do with them. And basically they would go and they would measure which city was the closest. And then there were some requirements of that city. The elders of that, in verse 4 of chapter 21, elders of that city shall bring the heifer down to a valley with running water, which has not been plowed or sown, and shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley. Then the priests, the sons of Levi, shall come near, for the Lord your God has chosen them to serve him and to bless in the name of the Lord, and every dispute and every assault shall be settled by them. All the elders of that city which is nearest to the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley, and they shall answer and say, our hands did not shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it. Forgive your people Israel, whom you have redeemed, O Lord, and do not place a guilt of innocent blood in the midst of your people Israel, and the blood guiltiness shall be forgiven them. So you shall remove the guilt of the innocent blood from your midst when you do what is right in the eyes of the Lord. That is a very seemingly complicated process. So if a man was found killed and your city happened to be closest to this man and you didn't know what happened to him, you had to go get a heifer, go in the valley with water, break its neck, and then have this ceremony over at Washington saying that you didn't know, you know, who had killed this man and that you hadn't done it. And so I think some of the ideas here is that the Israelites in these cities were had the responsibility, first of all, not to murder people, but also I think to enforce God's laws. And so this is the idea that they were guilty of this man's death until they, but once they went through this ceremony, they were relieved of that guilt. Now that seems very strange that I would be guilty over something that happened that I didn't have anything to do with. And I think we can look at the way I look at that and think that we could apply to our lives today is if we have a, how can I be guilty of sin if somebody else did? If I didn't do anything to, you know, if my brother sins and I don't do anything to correct him, to do anything about it, to help him, you know, put that out of his life, then under this idea, this principle, I would be guilty as well. And obviously we can't go and break a heifer's neck in the valley today, but it's the idea that I think we need to take seriously looking out for our brothers. And you know, we don't like doing this. I don't like doing it. I don't like getting in other people's business. But when I see or you see one of your brothers erring, I think we have the responsibility to help them or do something about it. That's kind of the idea that they had the responsibility for this man's death. And they had, because they didn't know, they had to go through this offering to be forgiven them, for that to be given them. The next law is kind of given here is in verses 10 through 14. And this also is something that I don't know that we're going to, you know, is going to apply much to us today. If you've gone out, when the Israelites had gone out to one of these distant cities and conquered and brought back the women and children, if somebody had found one of these women and they wanted to make them their wife, there were some rules that they had to go by. And I think some of these rules give some, well, if you were going to do that, one of the things you had to do is that you had to give her a month to at least mourn for her father and mother. Because I'm going to assume that you had killed her father, the Israelites had killed her father in the battle. And I'm not sure, maybe she'd just been taken from her mother. And so she would be given this time to mourn for them. They would give her a change of clothes that she wouldn't be wearing the same clothes that she wore from the city. I guess they probably had different regions of the world, probably had different styles of clothes. But then if you didn't approved of her, you couldn't mistreat her. You couldn't sell her for money. It says that you could send her away, but there were a lot of rules that went along with that. It's very unusual, very complicated. And I don't think that it is God at this point in time that he is telling people, you know, it's okay for divorce. I think this is one of those situations where God knows that people aren't necessarily going to do what's right, but in order to protect these women that would be, you know, taken in as slaves, he's making some laws to allow for them to have some protection. And so we see that if we look back, you know, throughout the Old Testament, there are several passages that reveals that God, you know, doesn't approve that. If we, you know, look at some passages, you know, talking about God creating male and female. In Malachi, there's passages, Malachi, the second chapter, we can look at some of those talking about, you know, God expecting whenever you get married that you are married, you know, that you become one flesh. There's also here in this chapter, in chapter 8, in verse 18, if a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey his father or mother, when they chastise him, he will not even listen to him, then his father and mother shall seize him and bring him out to the elders of his city at the gateway of his hometown. They shall say to the elders of his city, This son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Then all the men of his city shall stone him to death. So you shall remove the evil from your midst, and all Israel will hear of it and fear. At the end of this, we have this statement again, all Israel will hear of it and fear. Hear of it and fear. I think that's the idea. That's trying to encourage young men not to be rebellious of their parents, because they're going to know this law. And so, and if to me, this is another one of those things that if your son is stubborn, he's going to have to be really stubborn and really rebellious in order for you to take him to the city to be stoned. So here we see that he's to be taken out and stoned. This law is done so that the evil can be removed from Israel. It says, so you shall remove the evil from your midst. There's a parable. I'm not going to turn there and read there for time's sake, but we all know the parable of the prodigal son. Clearly, this son, I would say, falls into stubborn and rebellious. He wanted his inheritance. He left. He was clearly a glutton and a drunkard. But we see that the father took him back. The father went and killed the fatted goat for him. And this is, you know, typically this is our, you know, what we go to whenever we talk about, you know, a returning brother, one that would return from sin. That is, clearly we aren't to, you know, today stone anybody. I don't think that's even a question. But this was done to, I think, show the seriousness that sin in the midst of Israel, the damage that it would cause. It's beyond my imagination to, you know, to be in that situation where you would take your son and do that. But that was God's law. And so I want to move on to verses 22 and 23. This talks about if a man has committed a sin worthy of death and is put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his corpse shall not hang all out on the tree, but you shall surely bury him on the same day. For he who is hanged is accursed of God, so that you do not defile your land, which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. And if anybody can read this and not immediately think about Christ, I don't know how you could do that. One of the things about this, it says if the man has committed a sin worthy of death, you know, he's to be hanged on a tree. Clearly, if we look at Christ, Christ committed no sin. All right. But yet he was hanged on a tree. And it says here, if he was hanged on a tree, he's cursed of God. And we know that if you remember from the account of the crucifixion, they went to the Romans. They wanted them to break Jesus' legs so he would die, so he wouldn't be hanging there overnight, so he wouldn't be there, you know, through, you know, over the weekend. And so I want to just turn and look at some passages in John, the 19th chapter, verses 31 and 32. Since it was a day of preparation, so that the bodies would not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for the Sabbath was a high day, the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken, but that they might be taken away. So the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and the other who had been crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus, they saw he was already dead and did not break his legs. And also I want to read in Galatians, the third chapter, in verse 13. Says, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone who is hanged on a tree. So then Christ Jesus, the blessings of Abraham, might come to the Gentiles so that we might receive the promised Spirit through faith. We go back to earlier, we talked about you know, Christ had committed no sin, but yet he redeemed us from the curse of the law, because we have been cursed by the law because we committed the sin. And he received that punishment. He was hung up. We deserved to be the sentence of death. We deserved to be hung on a tree, but yet Christ suffered that punishment for us. That's the end of chapter 21. If you want to open it back up, anybody's got any comments on chapter 21?
Because it drew attention to themselves.
Don't shatter
ours. All right, well, let's go on to chapter 22 then. Chapter 22, my Bible in the, you know, above each chapter, I have a little bitty a heading. And this is called, mine says sundry laws. It's kind of laws that are, you know, not exactly all linked together, but they do have some common theme there. It says, you shall not see your countryman's ox or his sheep straying away and pay no attention to them. You shall certainly bring them back to your countrymen. I don't know how many of you all are familiar with livestock and maybe, you know, living in the country. I guess it was about a year or two ago, I went to leave to work and there was a bull standing in my front yard. And, you know, the easy thing to do is like, is just to drive on to, you know, it's time for me to go to work. This bull is fairly valuable. I'd say very valuable. Bull is also fairly dangerous too. You take a 2,000 pound bull, walks out into the highway and somebody hits him, somebody's going to die. Or likely somebody could die. If you take that bull, he may get excited. You know, most bulls aren't as mean as we think they are. He may hurt somebody. But it was the idea that we are to be looking out for our neighbor's property. If you go on and read this, it talks about even if you don't know whose it is. So say you're an Israelite and some sheep walk up into your yard and somebody's lost those sheep, clearly. You are to, you know, you don't know whose they are. You get them, you catch them for him, you keep them until they come looking for them. And so we are to be looking out for the interest of their neighbors is the idea that I see in this. It goes on down and gives some very, you know, list different animals, the donkeys in here. And so if you see your donkey, if you see your countryman's donkey or his ox falling down the way and pay no attention to them, you shall certainly help to raise them up. So even if you go down the road and you see somebody's animal that's fallen in a ditch or down, it's an odd thing about big animals. Sometimes if they lay down too long, their legs will go to sleep, like, and they have nerve damage and can't stand up. They'll die if they fall in. A lot of times they'll fall into a ditch and not be able to get out of it just because of the way, you know, their bodies are made. How much more relevant does that make the story or the parable of the man on the road to Jericho? Clearly, people have more value to God than animals. Here was this guy laying beaten on the side of the road, and they just kept passing by. And their law says they weren't even to do that to an animal, let alone a man. And so, especially one of their own countrymen. But what about us today? How should we respond to that, to our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ and to people of the world? Are we to just, you know, go on, pass by somebody? We see them laying in a ditch physically, you know, financially, spiritually. We're to be there. I think even spiritually is even more important. Oftentimes we run into people whose life is it's a wreck. I've come into contact with a lot of people like that, and they need God. They need understanding of how that they need to have salvation. And because how much more dangerous is it to be lost spiritually than to be physically, you know, stuck in a ditch? That's kind of one of the ideas that I got from that. Also, there's a verse in here about a man shall not wear woman's clothes, nor shall a man put on woman's clothing. Whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord your God. Couple of thoughts on that. One is that, you know, this is could clearly be talking about, you know, homosexuality and trying to be the other gender. Also, there were some, they believe that there were some idolatry practices that people would do that. And so that would be some type of idolatrous worship as well. In verses 6 and 7, here's one that applies to us every day. I mean, I can't think of a day that this happens to me. It says, if you happen to come along a bird's nest along the way, in any tree or on the ground with young ones or eggs, and the mother sitting on the young or on the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall certainly let the mother go, but the young you shall take for yourselves in order that you may dwell with you and that it may prolong your days. So here's the idea. If you come across a bird's nest, you're not allowed to take, I guess, to eat both the bird and the eggs or the young, but you're to let one of those go, or the mother go. Lots of different things I kind of read on that. One is that was to preserve the nature. If you kill both of them, then they wouldn't have the ability to continue to reproduce on the earth. That possibly could be it. I think that God would have that power to keep that species going if that was not his command. But I think that shows God's compassion for, you know, all of his creation, that we are to show respect for it because God cares for his creation. I think we should as well. Now, I know that, you know, clearly he allows them to eat the young or the eggs. And so we are, you know, he tells us that everything that, you know, moves on the earth is food for us. But I think at that same time, we need to have respect for his creation. Then moving on down here, there's some laws about the mixing of things together. And one of the ideas is that this is, you know, the law that this is some laws that derive from not committing adultery. And if you look at verse 9 here, for example, it says, you shall not sow your vineyard with two kinds of seed, or all the produce of the seed which you have sown, and the increase of the vineyard will become defiled. You know, it's hard for us to, you know, at first glance to think about that being, you know, in with the laws that we're concerned about adultery. You should not plow with an ox and a donkey together. You should not wear material mixed with wool and linen together. I think these are things that God has said that, you know, that are different and you shouldn't put together, whether that be I think that may be a ceremonial type thing. I mean, I can't think of clearly, you know, God has more reason than I could ever think of, but why you couldn't sow two different type of seed. I think that it has to do with, you know, being a ceremonial thing, that certain things aren't to be mixed together. And so that's kind of my thoughts on that. And then if we move on down to verse 13 through 20 of this chapter, deals into some more laws about morality. It says, if a man takes a wife and goes into her and then turns against her and charges her with shameful deeds and publicly defames her and says, I took this woman, but when I came near her and did not find her a virgin, then the girl's father and mother shall take and bring out the evidence of the girl's virginity to the elders of the city gate. The girl's father shall say to the elders, I gave my daughter to this man for a wife, but he turned against her. And behold, he has charged her with shameful deeds, saying, I did not find your daughter a virgin, but this is the evidence of my daughter's virginity, and they shall spread the garment before the elders of the city. So the elders of the city shall take the man and chastise him, and they shall fine him 150 shekels of silver and give it to the girl's father because he publicly defamed a virgin of Israel, and she shall remain his wife, and he cannot divorce her all his days. And so Here we have this situation where the man is supposed to have, he's claiming that his wife wasn't a virgin when he found her, and it has shamed her, and his her parents are to bring out this evidence. And then whenever he finds, whenever they evaluate the evidence, and they determine that she was, and this man is fined money, and then it says he was not allowed to divorce her all his days. And so here I think we have an idea where evidence, I guess they can use physical evidence, if you will, to make decisions about these things. And I think that this is the idea that this man cannot divorce her all his days is the plan that God, you know, that he has for us as, you know, as his people, that when we're married, we're to remain married to that person all of our days. Then if we go on down through here, there's a list of several different, I guess, sexual immoral things that are forbidden. And the punishment for these things is death for all these different things. And the only one that is in this list here, and I don't want to, you know, go back and read those. If a man finds a woman and she's engaged and he attacks her, doesn't use the term rape, but I think that's what I perceive from the way it's described there, then the man is to be put to death, but the woman is not to be punished. And all these laws are written and further described because I think that God has designed these laws to stress the importance of, you know, of monogamy and how that is God's plan for us. And we see that if we look around our world today, we see that clearly that is not how most of the world, you know, perceives things. And I would say that even in those days, it probably was not much different. And I want to look at a passage in Hebrews, the 13th chapter, in verse 4. It says, let the marriage bed be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled, for God will judge the sexually immoral and adulterous. So here we see that this all goes around to talk about, you know, God's plan, how God expects purity with that, you know, through, you know, sexual purity for us as his children. And also, and at the very end of this, in verse 30, it says, it talks about a man shall not take his father's wife so that he will not uncover his father's skirt. And if we think about, you know, I think it was in 1 Corinthians where they had a Christian there that had, you know, taken his father's wife, and how the punishment there was not, it doesn't specifically say, you know, in verse 30 here, that person should be put to death, but all these other ones, you know, that was the punishment. But they were to, you know, they were to put him out of the church so that he could be punished, so that he would receive that punishment so he could repent and return and be a Christian with him. I think I've, you know, gone a little longer than what I thought it would take. I'm probably going to end right there today. I guess we'll open that back up to, you know, questions or comments before we go ahead and adjourn. Anybody have any thoughts or comments? Nate, has he got a hand up?
Yeah. I mean, it's going through some of this, you know, sometimes uncomfortable for us to read or to think about, but it's so easy to see how Jesus just sums it up when he says, you know, serve God first and love your neighbor as yourself. If we keep those things in mind first of putting God first and then others second, and like serving ourselves last and, you know, far down the list, we can see how that type of mindset and life living would fulfill all of these. It's just, you know, it's just striking that, you know, that took them that many thousand, you know, hundreds of years for Jesus to finally come forth and just be like, this sums the whole thing up, guys.
All right. Thank you. Anybody else have any thoughts or comments? Okay. If not, I guess we'll end right there. We'll start back on chapter 23. It was good to see all you all and hear from all you all. Still looking forward to getting back where we can be meeting in person, face-to-face. We'll probably really appreciate that more than we ever did before following this. But thank you all for tuning in and going through this class with me. I guess I'll see you on Wednesday in Mark.